Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello, and thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'm going to put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, some clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. A warm welcome. I'm Jeremy Maggs. Coming up on the program today, the trade union Solidarity takes aim at race-based hiring rules in a fresh policy battle. 2 years in, and is South Africa's deposit insurance scheme ready to be tested? The Deputy Reserve Bank Governor is standing by to talk to me. New tax rules leave South African expats exposed to frozen bank accounts, and rising costs lay bare a growing financial literacy crisis across the country. And it's not just low-income earners who are sweating. It is Wednesday, the 15th of April. Now, the trade union Solidarity wants employers to stop using race requirements in job adverts, saying many companies are going beyond what the law demands. But in a country that is still in many respects shaped by exclusion, the argument is not just legal, it's political, and I guess it's a moral one as well. So is this a stand for fairness, or is it a pushback against transformation itself? Anton van der Bijl is the head of the legal department at Solidarity and joins me now. Anton, let's get some context first, and thank you for joining us. How widespread, in your opinion, is this practice?
Jeremy, yes, I think it's widespread if you look at many advertisements at this point in time. And over the country, you can see that the prerequisite of race is part and parcel of that advertisements. So no, it's a quite common practice. We say it's unfortunate that it is. So if you look at the laws, it's not required by law, but yeah, it's a common practice in South Africa.
And across which sectors in the main, Anton?
No, we see it in many sectors. We have seen in the past few weeks in the, in multinational companies as well. We have seen it at Coca-Cola. We have seen it at Bitvest and at other companies as well. So it's not only limited to a certain sector. It's over the whole of South Africa.
And why is Solidarity now taking issue with this?
Well, not only now, we have done so the past 20 to 30 years. We have litigated on many fronts against these types of practices. And the question that we have been asked on many previous occasions, are we anti-transformation? No, we're not anti-transformation. We, if you look solely at the advertisements and you look at the wording of the requirements, you will see that to only say that one race can apply for a position is against not only South African laws, but it's also against international obligations. And you don't have to look far. If you look at the Employment Equity Act, and specifically Section 15 thereof, you can clearly see that the allocation of a certain position to a certain race is prohibited. So it's not far-fetched. It's in the law. And we only stand on law to say that this practice is not lawful and it cannot be so.
So you say that you're defending fairness, that you're not resisting transformation. So if you support redress then or redress, what should it look like in practice then as far as this particular avenue of advertisement is concerned?
Well, just to clearly set out what we have said in this and in many previous occasions, in this specific instance, we say that there's a prerequisite in the advertisements that it cannot be so. It's unlawful, it's irrational, and it's against constitutional principles. So we don't say in general we are against anti-transformation, and we have not said that we are for the current application of affirmative action. So yeah, I just want to make clear that this is a specific instance where we say in the specific instance this is not lawful and cannot be so. So yeah, that's in short what we are arguing this matter. And if you look at our many previous court cases as Well, it's against certain principles, certain policies, which is unlawful. And you will see now in no of those court cases we are in general against against transformations in general.
So if you say then that it's unlawful and irrational, in other words, if the law does not require race-based adverts, why do you think employers still use them?
Well, I think it's politically correct, and it's nice to say in general in the public that this is what we do. We are for the current politics in South Africa, and therefore we institute this own type of requisite in these policies. So I think it's politically correct. If you look at case law and you look at international conventions, and you don't have to look far, you can just look at the UN Convention of the ILO 111. It clearly says that this is not the way that affirmative action should be applied. If you look at affirmative action, it must be based on socioeconomic need and not on race, and there must be a sunset clause. So it's not an open-ended policy when you say transformation must be representativity, where every sector in South Africa must reflect the demographics of South Africa. No, you must look at what's a socioeconomic need, and then you must have an end term for the application of affirmative action.
If, Anton, you're suggesting that it's politically correct, that could mean many things. Do you think companies are acting out of caution or fear of the state?
Well, I think to a certain extent, fear of the state, possibly. You can have a compliance officer of the Department of Labor coming to your front door if you say that now I'm going to appoint predominantly based on merits and not on race. So you can have the government coming after you if you do not do what some companies do. But the question still begs whether it's in terms of the law, whether it's lawful or not. And we say it's not lawful. So if the Department of Labor come knocking on your door and asking you what's your policy, you must say we apply affirmative action, but it's nuanced. We look at what's good for South Africa. We look at what's good for my company. And thereafter, if all things are equal, then we apply affirmative action. And that's the way it should happen in South Africa, not an open blanket quota system where there's absolute barrier to the non-designated group where they cannot apply for certain positions. That's not the way to do it.
Anton, let me suggest that you might be arguing a very moot point here. Let's assume that race comes out of the advert but still stays in the hiring decision. Nothing has really changed, right?
Well, it has changed. To say that, well, what we have at this point in time is you have something that's unlawful, and that must be eradicated. To say that it might be unlawful or not lawful, and we must take that out, but the outcome will still be some other race proxy decision. That's for us, or that's for another argument to be made and to be argued in court. If there's an interview process and there's decision, and we say that the applicant that was appointed was solely based on race and no other factor was taken into account, let's say the difference between candidate A and candidate B is 10%, then there might be an argument to be made in court that that decision was based solely on race. The law, the employment equity law, and the international conventions was not taken into account. But yeah, it might be so, but that's an argument that we will make on a later stage. But what we can say at this point in time is that you cannot have an advertisement which says that a certain position can only be applied by a designated employee.
And just quickly, what do you say to black professionals then who hear this maybe as a defense of white privilege?
Well, it's not so. At the end of the day, we say you have an unlawful advertisement. You have many competent black, white, any type of employees. But to say you cannot apply solely based on the color of your skin, that's absolutely ridiculous. That cannot happen. So we have a past that that needs to be rectified, but at the way to do it is not by placing these types of criteria in your advertisements. That cannot be so.
Anton van der Bael, thank you very much indeed, head of the legal department at Solidarity.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, South Africa's deposit insurance scheme was meant to strengthen trust in the banking system by protecting qualifying depositors up to 100,000 rand per depositor per bank if a bank fails. Now, CODI has been operational since the 1st of April 2024, as I understand it. It's funded by banks rather than depositors, and the Reserve Bank says around 95% of depositors are fully covered. But I think the real question now is whether the cover is high enough, whether the public actually understands what is and is not protected, and whether the scheme will work smoothly if it is truly tested. Dr. Mampo Modisi is Deputy Governor at the South African Reserve Bank and joins me now. Dr. Modisi, welcome. So the scheme is live. It's been live for some time. But can you truly say that it's working if South Africa has not yet seen it tested in a major bank failure?
Thank you for having me. We have tested CODI, but we did it with a small bank, this Ditsobotla Bank, and we identified some of the improvements that we needed to implement. One of those was that we have to think about getting payment agent banks, which are those banks that will step in, being paid by CODI to do the payment. We're in the process of finalizing procurement, and that will help us intensely. In case a bank fails, we will know we will have the banks ready to help us. Secondly, we have intensified the data sources that we get from the banks just to make sure CODI has all the depositor data in case something happens. So we did learn quite a lot of a few things on the gaps that we identified, and now we're working on closing those gaps.
If a bank were to fail tomorrow, Dr. Modisi, how quickly would an ordinary depositor realistically get access to their money?
20 days, Jeremy, for now, and we're working on reducing that to around 7 days. And it's because it's 20 days because we're still validating the data sets of the banks. Once that is finalized, that will reduce considerably to 7 days.
Another question that has been asked is around the 100,000 rand and whether that is really enough in 2026, or is that figure already too low, do you think, for many households and smaller businesses?
So, Jeremy, the 100,000 covers 95% of the depositors, and we think that that is still sufficient. Of course, every 5 years we'll have to review that number and see if it is still fit for purpose. But for now, it covers 95% of the depositors that we have.
But only around 23% of total deposit value is covered. Does that not show, Dr. Modisi, the protection is broad politically but limited financially?
I think, Jeremy, the key is understanding the purpose of CODI. CODI is there to make sure that depositors can function and depositors can get their money as soon as possible. It doesn't mean that above the 100,000, you're not going to get your money. It will just take longer because it will follow the normal processes of closing a bank, whether it's liquidation or whether it's sell-off. So the depositors will get their top-off money. But here, we're just looking at the functioning of the financial system and making sure that there's no disruptions in the system. So they're not losing their money. It's just that they're getting it in 20 days rather than waiting for formal legal processes.
Dr. Modisi, how confident are you that ordinary customers actually understand that things like unit trusts, shares, e-money products are actually not covered?
So we're on a drive now for public awareness. We've circulated the updated one to the banks, and we're also having interviews just to explain to depositors what is covered and what is not covered. You're right, Jeremy. There's a number of people who don't understand what is covered, and we need to make sure, as the sub, that we educate and we clarify what is covered. So with those public awarenesses, we campaigns, we're hoping that we will reach out more people, and they will get to understand what CODI is and what is covered.
And that's part of the problem because small firms, maybe stock fells, community savers are crucial, as we know, in the South African economy. But are you satisfied that the scheme protects them properly, or do you think that there are still grey areas that exist?
There will always be grey areas, Jeremy, that exist. That's why I think, as and when CODI grows and we do the assessments, we identify those grey areas and we put in place measures to resolve those. But for now, I think for entities like Stokvels, the manner in which we're covering it, it's sufficient. But we also have to look at whether there's better ways in which we can do the cover for those Stokvels where you find it's multiple customers and they don't have accounts. Do we cover them sufficiently? So, for example, if you have someone or a Stokvel where there's five people but only one person is registered in the bank, that one person will be covered. Vis-a-vis, if it's five people, while all those five people are covered or registered with the bank, those five people will be covered. So things like those, we have to start assessing and see whether can we have a scheme that is tailor-made for Stokvels, and we communicate that properly.
Do you think banks are doing enough to explain CODI clearly?
It is the sub's job to make sure that we communicate CODI clearly, and the banks are helping us, or they conduit to that. So it is our responsibility to make sure that we communicate CODI clearly. That's why we need to work with banks, but other entities, we also have to start talking to those that can help us spread the message of CODI.
The fund is built from, as I understand it, bank premiums and other bank-linked funding. Is there a risk that the cost is simply passed on to customers by the commercial banks through fees or lower returns?
So, Jeremy, when we were designing the scheme, one, we looked at the levy, we looked at how much it's going to cost us to build the fund, and we looked at the timelines of when we think we can build the fund. And so far, what we've done is we reduced the cost to the banks to between 14 rand to 20 rand per depositor, and we think that is low enough. But of course, the Financial Sector Conduct Authority, we worked with them to ensure that there is no transfer of fees to the depositors that is unjustified by the commercial banks. But when we were designing the scheme, because of the low levies and the premiums from the banks, we think that there wouldn't be a significant impact to customers. But the FSCA is working with us to make sure that the banks don't transfer costs to customers that are not justified.
What do you think the biggest weakness in the scheme is today, and what needs to change before South Africa faces a real banking crisis?
The biggest one for now is trying to get the depositor data, the updated data. I mean, we're covering everyone from 1960 or whenever they opened the bank account. Some of the people don't exist. They're no longer clients of those banks. So to deal with that database and make sure that we have updated information, that's what we're finding as a challenge. But we are working with the banks, and we are encouraging depositors to please go to the banks and update their depositor information so that when CODI is looking for them, they can be found easily. But that is the critical part that we're dealing with right now.
Dr. Mampo Modisi, Deputy Governor at the South African Reserve Bank, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, as I understand it, for years, many South Africans living abroad moved money out of the country with relatively little friction. But all of that has changed under the new exchange control framework. Banks now require something called an Approval of International Transfer Certificate, or an AIT, before funds can be moved. And the warning is that without it, transfers can be stopped and accounts effectively frozen. So I think the real issue is whether South Africans abroad understand just how exposed they may be. may be if their tax residency status is still misaligned, and what SARS has on its system. Well, let's discuss that in a little more detail. I'm in conversation now with Jonty Leon, managing partner at tax and advisory firm The Leap Group. Jonty, welcome. Is this really a compliance cleanup, or has moving money out of South Africa just become a lot harder by design?
Hi, Jeremy. Thanks for having me. So I think it is both a compliance cleanup as well as a bit of a enforcement mechanism that SARS is now using to try and ensure that all taxpayers are compliant and that they're extracting every last bit of taxpayer money that they can.
What has actually changed then, Jonty, in practical terms for an expat trying to transfer money today than there was not, say, a year, 18 months ago?
Sure. So under the old system, all you needed was a good standing tax clearance certificate, and you were able to move funds abroad. Under the new system, the AIT, or Approval for International Transfer, it's not just a form that needs to be filled out, but it's an entire application process where SARS is able to dig into all of your affairs before they will allow you to move money out of the country.
Is the biggest danger here, Jonty, not the AIT itself, but maybe the fact that expats would wrongly assume that SARS already sees them as non-resident?
I think you've hit the nail on the head there. We've got the majority of South Africans that we deal with are outside of South Africa and may have been outside of South Africa for many, many years. But with the AIT application, you have to declare to SARS if you are a resident or non-resident. And this makes a massive difference. If you're a tax resident of South Africa, SARS is able to look into your local income and assets as well as your foreign income and assets. If you're a non-resident, they can only look at your South African local income and assets. And the problem is, if you are not noted correctly as a non-resident and you go and apply for an AIT, well, all of a sudden you've opened yourself up to SARS looking at your entire estate across the world.
I guess we've also got to ask how many South Africans then, this is probably difficult to answer, who've been living abroad, have maybe been living on a false sense of security. In other words, assuming they're compliant when in fact they are anything but.
Yeah, I mean, it is a difficult question to answer, but I mean, this is the business that we're in. So every single one of our clients is someone that is finally realizing that they aren't actually compliant. They think they're compliant. They look at their tax profile and everything looks, you know, hunky-dory to them, but they don't realize the pitfalls of tax residency. And that's where we have to come in and be proactive about it.
And if your tax residency status is wrong, I imagine, within the SARS system itself, you would effectively be inviting scrutiny of your entire global financial life. Could get tough.
Exactly that. That then gets quite sort of scary for taxpayers abroad, because they may have been there for many years and now they've got the worry that SARS wants to tax them on everything they've been building outside of South Africa as though they were tax residents here.
And Jonty, consequence is that accounts can effectively be frozen as I've outlined. How does that happen and how quickly could it happen then?
So it's happening quite often now. And basically, if you try to move money outside of SA, but you don't have the requisite approval from SARS, banks are now required, in terms of the exchange control regulations, the new exchange control regulations, to freeze your account until such time as you are fully compliant with SARS and have the requisite approval.
So let me choose my next words carefully here. Are banks then acting maybe as enforcers for SARS and exchange control in a more assertive or aggressive way than they were before?
I tend to agree with you on that statement, but only based on what regulation has now forced them to do so.
So what kind of recourse do you have if you find yourself on the other side of the law?
Well, that's where we need to sort of look at your SARS profile and say, how do we fix this? We need to now look back to when you left South Africa and, you know, approach SARS before you're on the back foot and they've approached you, to go and retrospectively fix all of that non-compliance and bring you up to date so that you don't fall into any traps going forward.
So what then is the first thing, do you think, an expat should check today after listening to our conversation if they try to move a single rand?
I think number one, are all your tax returns up to date? And do you have any penalties lying there with SARS or anything owing to SARS? And what their tax residency status is, because that at the end of the day determines what will need to be declared to SARS in terms of the AIT.
Jonty Leon, thank you very much indeed for the explanation. Managing partner at the tax and advisory firm, The Leap Group.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, April, you might or might not be aware, is Financial Literacy Month. But this year, the conversation, I think, is landing in a very difficult and a much harsher reality. With Middle East tensions driving oil risk, the rand is under increasing pressure, fuel costs are threatening food inflation, and household debt already dangerously high. Financial literacy is no longer a nice to have. The argument now is that in a volatile economy, understanding how to budget, borrow, save, and manage risk may be one of the few defenses that we actually can control. In conversation now with Denise Nietling, who's head of marketing at Pay Me Now. Denise, we talk at difficult in a difficult time. You call financial literacy a shield, but can knowledge really protect families when prices are often rising faster than incomes?
Definitely, Jeremy, yes. And thanks so much for the opportunity. Like you say, we are celebrating Financial Literacy Month, but it's a very different setting this year in which we face Financial Literacy Month. And definitely, yes, being financially literate can for sure help you in terms of managing your money better, because we can't prevent the storm. We can't tell you what's going to happen in the storm, but being financially literate can give you the guidance and the knowledge on how to best navigate through the storm. Knowing how to budget can help you save your money because you're spending wisely. Knowing how to manage your money is key to getting through the storm like you say, economic instability, things happening in the Middle East. And although it sounds like it's happening far away, it does have an impact right here on us at home with the fuel prices increasing. That has a direct line down to everything else increasing. So knowing how to navigate through it definitely helps.
I do take the point, but I also wonder to myself if we're not in danger of overstating personal responsibility when the real problem is a weak economy, rising costs, and we simply cannot control that.
That's very true. I mean, it's sad actually that the consumer is suffering under this, when what is happening is really, it's completely out of our control. It's completely something that we cannot control. At the end of the day, people are suffering, not just blue collar workers. Every person is suffering under this economic strain and what's happening. And yes, we're not just saying that you've got to do something personally, but it's somewhere to start. It's somewhere to start, because we cannot do anything about the situation globally or whatever else elements that are influencing it. But starting with yourself is maybe the first step on just getting yourself in, like, financially secure, or just getting that peace of mind and knowing how to manage, how to save, how to be going about managing your debt. If you've got debt levels, now cost of living is going up, cost of food is going up, what's happening in the Middle East is affecting my grocery bill, all of that. So yes, it's not the consumer's fault, and it's sad that it falls on the consumer to have to take the steps, but that is, we have to start somewhere, and that's maybe the best place to start.
I'm correct in saying that only about half of South Africans are considered financially literate. Is that a failure, do you think, of education? Is it the financial sector itself or government?
It's difficult to say. I think it might just be a case of accessibility, not having access to it, not having access to financial literacy, financial knowledge and modules and lessons. I don't think there's a specific sector to blame. It would be a very subjective opinion for me to give. But I think at the end of the day, it comes down to accessibility, being able to give people access to tools that they can use to empower themselves. And we've actually seen that when people have access to these tools, they're so eager to learn. So it's not, it's definitely not the people's fault that don't want to learn. I think it comes down to having access to it and being able to educate yourself to being financially literate. And when you're on a partner with a company, where there's many places nowadays online where you can get free online courses on how to educate yourself and increase your knowledge on financial literacy. So I think it comes to accessibility and just, be being able to open up more doors and platforms for people to increase their knowledge.
Having said that, though, can financial literacy on its own really change outcomes, or do we need better products and maybe lower cost access to money as well?
Oh, it's never just one element. I agree with you 100%. It has to be a collection of things. So yes, access is one thing, but better products is also another thing. And better support, better understanding. Through our platform, what we have at Pay Me Now, we try and really tick a whole bunch of boxes, because it's never just one thing that's going to create the solution. It's like when you think we've got a baking a cake. I'm not just going to need one ingredient. I'm going to need a whole bunch of ingredients to get to that beautiful end result. So yes, definitely, it's not just one element. It's financial literacy. It's accessing to the correct tools, accessing to the correct platforms, and the support that is needed from the necessary sectors and government and all that. So no, it's a whole bunch of elements, definitely.
The average consumer, as I understand it, is carrying more than 90,000 rand in debt on a median income of, as you suggest, 9,500 rand. This is unsustainable, and it's a full-blown debt crisis. That's all you can say about that, surely.
It is definitely. And the problem there is now with this Middle East climate, or this this issue that's happening in the Middle East, pushing up food prices and fuel prices, it becomes almost impossible for you just to pay for your normal trolley of food. And that also then leads to you not being able to cover your debt repayments. So it's got a massive, massive snowball effect, because everyday costs are going up. Now, added to this, people struggle even more to pay off their existing debt. So it really is a snowball effect that needs immediate attention. And that, again, comes to financial literacy, being able to be honest with yourself, to know, what is my debt situation? What are my options? Where can I turn to get debt relief or assistance in paying this off? Because a lot of people sit with the debt, but they don't know about all the tools or avenues that it's available to them to assist in paying off these debts. So yes, it's a massive snowball effect, and everything is related to each other.
But we live as human beings often in a state of complete denial, and it's human nature to kick the can up the road, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. It's much easier to pass the buck than what it is to face it yourself. But that's why we also say, again, be honest with yourself. In this month, April Financial Literacy Month, let's look it straight in the eye and see, okay, this is happening at the moment. This is our reality. And let's face it. Let's look at our budgets. Let's not work on a budget that was made a while ago. Let's look at our budget now. Is it still viable? Can I still use it? Understand your credit score. Again, knowing what a credit score is. We see on Pay Me Now, one of the financial modules or literacy modules that is mostly done is credit score education, because people don't know how that affects their, it's like a scorecard, how it affects any other decisions that's made when I apply for finance or anything like that. So it really is a fact that we need to pay attention to what our financial literacy is, and just face the music at this stage and try and navigate through the storm.
And just a quick one in conclusion, higher earners are also under pressure now. We shouldn't be surprised by that. It also suggests that the problems that you've outlined are no longer just a low income problem, right?
No, definitely. This is something that's hitting everybody at every level. Really, it's cost of living is going up. It's a perfect storm in the sense of having to navigate through, and everybody's having to navigate through it. This is something that is affecting every pocket. It's affecting every person at every level. You need to get to a point where you're going to get better. But educating yourself is going to help you find that path much quicker than if you didn't know how to get there in the first place. So that's why I say financial literacy might not be the full-blown answer, but it's definitely the first step into getting you into the right direction in navigating this newness that we're in at the moment, with everything happening around us and from globally things happening affecting us in our own homes here on local ground. So that's why we're pushing for it, just to educate yourself to know how to navigate through the storm.
Denise Netling, thank you very much indeed from Pay Me Now. And that's where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.